Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Dan Bardell. Welcome to the England show on The Athletic. A big week ahead as England face Germany in the last 16 of Euro 2020 at Wembley on Tuesday evening. And on today's pod, we're going to take a look inside the training base Gareth Southgate's team are using to prepare at St George's Park.
Hello everyone, I'm Aaron Maguire. I don't know what day it is, but yeah, this is Derby Day.
We had a water balloon fight after training. Dean Henderson lost, he got ambushed. Somebody hit Jack Grealish when he wasn't expecting it. He's not fuming, he wants to get him back.
Okay. I think Harry Kane sorted it out for him to come in and, you know, he did a little sing-song while he was eating food, so I was just sat there looking at him like, oh my God, Ed Sheeran's right in front of me.
To help me on the panel from The Athletic, I'm joined by Ollie Kay, Jack Pitbrook and Dan Sheldon. Dan, welcome. Your England podcast debut this morning, I believe. I've read your piece on England and St George's Park and how things have been down there. Found it very, very interesting. Just want to tell our listeners a little bit what the aim of the piece were and what you were trying to get across.
The idea of the piece, really, and I put it together with Danny Taylor, obviously our colleague at The Athletic, and just sort of what is life like as a player inside St George's Park at the moment. You know, obviously they're in a COVID bubble, so they can't see family and friends or anything like that. So it's what have the FA put on to offer the players as kind of entertainment, because, you know, we all know professional footballers don't spend from 9 till 5 on a football pitch training. You know, it may be 2-3 hours and then there's a lot of downtime. So it's really just looking at, well, what are they up to in their spare time? What sort of games can they, you know, participate in? And that's kind of the crux of the piece. So yeah, me and Danny went away and, you know, did some digging and looked into it.
Yeah, I'll say straight off the bat, if you do want to go and read Dan's piece in full on The Athletic and subscribe for just £1 a month, you can do so at the moment by going to theathletic.com/England pod. Jack, welcome to the podcast as well. Of all our writers, you've probably been the closest to the England camp throughout the tournament. Can you just give us the general mood of the players and the coaches at the moment, how they're finding being at St George's Park?
Well, because of COVID restrictions, I've still been 160 miles away from St George's Park throughout. But from as much as I can deduce from Zoom calls with players and staff, I get the impression that it seems pretty happy and relaxed. You know, maybe in a sense it doesn't feel like a tournament, just because, you know, they're going to somewhere they're familiar with, which is St George's Park, where they go, you know, 4 or 5 times a year. They haven't gone abroad yet, England. They could, you know, if they lose to Germany, they will not go abroad at all. So in that sense, it has been different. But I get the impression that, and this is something that's conveyed really well in Dan and Danny's piece, that they have successfully recreated the kind of relaxed, friendly environment as far as is possible, given the COVID rules at St George's Park, which, you know, obviously was such a big part of their success in Russia 3 years ago.
Yeah, Ollie, I think in previous tournaments, even as recently as Euro 2016, the way the camp's been set up hasn't always been the greatest, but that's certainly one thing that Gareth Southgate seems to have got right in Russia, and he's carried it on for this tournament as well.
I think it's improved a lot over time. I think it's something that sort of evolved from, you know, go back to the 80s and the 90s, that there would be the coaches and the team would just be in a hotel. There wouldn't really be much thought about how they would spend their downtime. Then in the 2000s, they had Sven-Göran Eriksson, who had a very sort of relaxed approach to it, and the players were able to come and go. And then at the following World Cup, 2010, South Africa, Fabio Capello had this incredibly austere camp, which the players sort of likened to a prison, in that there was no, you know, there was stuff there for them to do, but they just felt the whole regime was so strict, they were confined to the bedroom for long periods. And so I think from the, you know, ever since then, really, the FA have been sort of moving in a different direction and making it a more sort of calm, relaxed atmosphere, and more, you know, just being aware of how much downtime the players have, as Dan said, and just trying to make that downtime as relaxed as possible while still allowing the training time and the preparation time to be as professional as possible.
Yeah, and Ollie, I'll stick with you. It feels like a long time since Gareth Southgate was a player now. Mm. But he does seem to be able to relate to the players a lot more than previous England managers, doesn't he?
He does. If you go back to Fabio Capello again, sorry for using that as the yardstick. I mean, Fabio Capello is probably the best manager certainly in my lifetime, best manager to have managed England. And you look at everything he did, but he didn't seem to understand the demands of an England squad at a major tournament. He felt that they needed that sort of Italian style, very rigorous, very disciplined approach. And these players were so much younger than him. They were sort of from a different culture and they didn't want to be sort of sent to their rooms for sort of 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon. They wanted to just sort of mingle and you know, mess around basically. And you see a lot of the stuff with the players these days, and it's you know, riding on inflatable unicorns in the pool and that kind of thing, and it's lighthearted, and there was no lightheartedness under Capello. I think Hodgson sort of moved it more in that direction, and now Southgate has very much had the point of view that, you know, these players, you know, they're sort of big kids, a lot of them. It's one thing having a games room, but they just want to be sort of stimulated, and they want to be, you know, they want to sort of bounce off each other and feed off that sort of cheery atmosphere rather than the sort of austere atmosphere that was the case in the past.
Yeah, I think in Dan's piece this time, they've got inflatable pizzas this year. I don't know whether Gareth Southgate's still got something going on with Pizza Hut, but it sounds like the unicorn's been ditched in favour of pizzas. Dan, can you just tell us a little bit what the players can get up to? What can they do for fun in the camp?
Yeah, for sure. You missed out the inflatable watermelons they've got as well. So it's pizza and watermelon.
I didn't have a clever joke about watermelon, so I left it.
They've replaced the unicorn. So look, we've all seen the basketball court and the players kind of, Mason Mount, you know, I think he got a swish. Is it a swish in basketball where he got it from distance and it went straight in basketball terms?
I think it's swoosh.
And then they got the F1 simulator, which was put in for this tournament. So, you know, the chair with a big kind of screen, and yeah, they can pretend they're Lewis Hamilton for the day, although that's particularly difficult, apparently. And the golf simulator, they've had one of those there. So if they can't get out on the golf course, which they did manage to do this week, they can hit, like, you know, pretend they're playing golf on a wherever. Table tennis, we've all seen those. Flotation tank, which is more akin to recovery, to be fair, but it's like a little tank where they can go and lay in. There's like half a ton of salt in it, so they just float, and apparently that's very relaxing. You've got breakout zones. If they want a quiet 5 minutes, they can go and sit in a corner, and it's a little quiet area. Coffee-style shop away from the canteen near breakfast. So again, it was described to me, if they want a change of scenery, they can walk across to a coffee-style shop where they sell smoothies and juices and all sorts. So yeah, there's quite a lot on offer, to be fair, and that's probably not half of it.
Yeah, it sounds a million miles away from some of the camps that Ollie's just described. Jack, it sounds all right, don't it?
Yeah, it does sound really good. And it is good that the FA have put all this time and money into putting on something for the players. Like, obviously, it will help them to perform better. You know, we need the players to be relaxed and refreshed, like mentally and physically, when they're playing these very high-pressure matches. So in that sense, I think it's really good. I also think it's good because it's so... If the FA were too nice... There's always a danger with this kind of thing. If the FA were too generous and they get criticised by some papers for, look at all this nice stuff they put on for the footballers, shouldn't they be focusing on training and tactics and that sort of bollocks? So I think it's good that the FA isn't worried about that kind of coverage or criticism and is willing to risk... Yeah, it's willing to risk getting it in the neck from some aspects of the media in defence of their players and just trying to help their players to relax and perform well. So I definitely think it's a good thing, yeah.
I think the only thing that they're criticised for is bringing in Ed Sheeran. I think that was beyond the pale in some people's eyes.
Do you think that's a punishment or a reward?
Well, I guess we'll have to find out whether Mason Mount and Ben Chilwell got, you know, got were excluded, or whether they had some kind of private gig between, you know, for the two of them, as you know, that would suggest it was punishment. But saw various interviews crop up yesterday where lots of England players were raving about Ed Sheeran, so they were clearly funny things footballers, aren't they?
Can't say it'd be my idea of having a great time, but yeah, fair play, each to their own. Jack, because obviously a lot of it is hosted in England and they're at St George's Park, which is familiar to them. Do you think if it wasn't for COVID, that they'd be allowed to see more of their families, and Southgate would make families more of a part of the whole occasion, the whole tournament?
Yeah, I'm sure that is the case. I'm sure that if they didn't have to follow COVID rules and were still at SGP, I imagine they would probably, I don't know how they do it, they'd probably have maybe a family day after every game, or maybe once a week they'd have a day where either the families could come on site to see the players, or perhaps the players would be let off site to see their families. I'm not sure exactly how, I mean, Ollie will know more about this than me, but Baden-Baden 2006, I believe that the families and WAGs were believed to have been too present, too involved, too much of a distraction. And I'm sure the FA would want to guard against that, although that said, you know, this is no longer the kind of golden generation celebrity era. I think, frankly, if you ask most people in the UK who, you know, the wives and girlfriends of the England players were, they wouldn't know, which is a very different from the situation that it was 15 years ago. So given that, as long as they guarded against any potential distractions like that, I'm sure in theory they would integrate some family time. But I suppose that's why that's another hurdle, really, that the FA are having to cross this summer.
Ollie, how much of a part of families played in some of the tournaments that you've covered?
The one that people always cite, as Jack just cited now, is 2006 in Baden-Baden. And there was, I mean, I wrote a piece about this before the tournament, about the sort of contrasting camps that they've had down the years. Sven-Göran Eriksson's view was that, you know, these guys are away for a month. They need, their families are here to watch the World Cup. It's nice if they can have as much family time as they like. So there were players sort of finishing training and going off down the hill into Baden-Baden to spend the afternoon with their families. That was happening every day. And I know that a few of the players just felt it went too far. And in the build-up to the quarterfinal, you know, a few of the senior players went to Eriksson and said, look, this is ridiculous. We've got the biggest match of our lives on Saturday, a World Cup quarterfinal. And we've got, I won't name the player, going off to his, you know, his daughter's birthday and saying he's got to do, he's got to sort of be with his daughter as she gets her birthday cake in the afternoon, straight after training. And it was felt that was too relaxed. It was also a thing in Baden-Baden where, you know, the players' wives and families were out sort of every night, and they were out on, you know, there was a big media pack, paparazzi media pack sort of following them around everywhere. And some of the wives hated that, and some of them absolutely loved it, to the extent where some people were suspicious that some relationships had been concocted just for this particular jaunt. But it was, there were players who were out, you know, there were players who were cooped up in their hotels in Baden-Baden texting journalists saying, is it true my wife was, you know, dancing on a piano? Is it true that my wife was sort of up till 5 a.m. and, you know, all this kind of thing? It was really unsettling to players, a lot of them. So that's clearly not, you know, that was clearly taking that nice idea of a relaxed camp and taking it to an extreme, and it didn't work. And obviously they went to the other extreme in South Africa 4 years later. And it was just this perception, really, that, you know, as with managers, this manager too strict, this manager too soft, this manager too defensively rigorous, this two manager to kind of off the cuff like Kevin Keegan. It was a perception that the camps were going from too relaxed to too strict. And ever since then, I think, starting with Roy Hodgson in Krakow in 2012, it's just been a lot more relaxed. Trying to do what the Dutch players do and the German players do, where it's just a bit more sensible, a bit more grown up in some ways, where you're not telling kids, the players, they have to be locked up in a room like kids for 3 hours a day, and not that I do that with my kids, but the it's just seems to be about finding that balance. I think, you know, I've never heard of any complaints in Rapino about how the camp was. I haven't heard of any complaints this time in at St George's Park, but I guess it's more likely that you would hear complaints if they were losing games, and there was that negativity around it. So it's all just one ingredient as to how you sort of keep the camp happy.
Yeah, it's such a young squad as well this time around compared to some of the tournaments that you would have covered, Ollie. Dan, when you were putting your piece together, I don't know whether you would have been able to find out this, but just does Southgate go to his leadership group and find out the kind of things that they want around the camp, or is it him and the FA that make the decision? Are the players involved at all?
There is dialogue between Gareth and his players about the kind of things that they may want, but I think what's important to stress is Gareth isn't stupid. He really does understand his players and his players' needs. I think he has a very close bond with a lot of his players. Maybe not Jack Grealish, but the other ones, perhaps he does certainly have a close bond with. So I'm sure there would have been discussions with the likes of Jordan Henderson, Harry Kane, two senior players about the setup of this camp. And I think the FA, and when I put the piece together, I spoke to a few people, and the logistics team of the FA were, you know, routinely praised for the work they actually did in Rapino. Like, a lot of the credit was put on the work they did for making that camp the camp it was. And then Gareth made a conscious effort to take all the best bits from Rapino into St. George's Park this time around. So I think Gareth, you know, will deserve credit for how he handled the camp in Russia. But ultimately, as Ollie said, when you're winning games, everyone's happy. So then you can take the bits that he knew everyone would have enjoyed there into St. George's Park. And I think that's kind of how they're doing it. It's an organic kind of process. It's, you know, they realise when things go bad, okay, we won't do that again. If things are good, okay, let's do that. And how can we improve it for next time?
Do you know, Dan, if they watch the games together? So obviously the other night when we were trying to work out who England were playing and it was changing on a minute-by-minute basis, would the players have been grouped together or watching that game?
Yeah, so it came to our attention that the players and staff kind of all gathered together in the main lobby to watch Group F kind of unfold. But prior to that, the main place they've caught games is in the massage room, like the treatment room. Obviously, a lot of players spend a fair bit of time in there. So I was told the FA put TVs in there. So that's where a lot of the players will sit and watch the games. But for the Group F, kind of how that unfolded, they're all in the main lobby together, watching that on two screens.
Jack, do you know how the players are feeling at the moment? Obviously, they've got the COVID stuff with Mount and Chilwell going on at the moment. They now know it's going to be such a big game at Wembley on Tuesday. Have you got the vibe at the camp?
I think it's pretty content, to be honest. Conversations I've had with sources over the last few days, they've said, you know, they're happy with Southgate, happy with the camp, happy with the approach. You know, one contact said to me that they're very aware of the fact that you can win a World Cup through 1-0s. You know, Spain in 2010 won all four of their knockout games 1-0. France in 2018 had a few games where they scored quite a few goals, but their most important wins really were Uruguay 2-0 and Belgium 1-0 in the quarters and semis. So I think the camp are very aware of the fact that you don't have to blow teams away with incredible attacking football in order to win a tournament, which really has been the message from Southgate throughout. So I don't get the sense of any grumblings about the approach or the setup or the tactics or anything like that. I think everyone is very on board with Southgate. That said, if England lose on Tuesday, everything will change. You know, if England lose on Tuesday, it'll be a disaster. It'll be, you know, three wasted years, massive step back from 2018. Questions about Southgate. Is he too nice? Is he too soft? Did he get the team wrong? All that kind of thing. All that stuff will happen. So, you know, these issues about mood are always incredibly dependent on results. But for now, yeah, I do get the impression it is a happy and relaxed place.
Yeah, and Ollie, in previous camps, would the press's mood have a massive effect on the players?
It has done on occasions. I mean, I remember, you know, I remember hearing and reading about, you know, during the 1990 World Cup, and the tabloids and the squad and the manager were almost at war. It felt like, you know, there was this massive sort of campaign against Bobby Robson, who sort of by the end of that tournament was being canonised by the same papers. But I'd say since then, I mean, in the periods when I've been covering England and you know, working as a journalist, I don't think the atmosphere has been that fraught between the squad and the media. I think there's been times, you know, in 2010, for example, where the team were playing abysmally, really, and they went out and they got a lot of criticism. But you know, that I think most of them accepted that, or if I accepted now, at least that a lot of the criticism was fair. And then I actually feel, in terms of the, you know, the media over more recent years, you know, the Hodgson years, the Southgate years so far, I think the media has been quite sort of patient, understanding, sympathetic, I think, when things have gone wrong for England. I think there's been a sense that, oh, look, you know, we're not going in with the sort of high expectations that we did in the 2000s. So Iceland 2016 was horrendous, and they got so much criticism about, you know, on the front pages, but I think on the back pages it was generally, I don't know, it was condemning the performance and saying what was wrong, but it wasn't personal or anything like that. And then 2018 obviously was such an unexpected sort of joyful tournament, and 2021, now there is expectation, and we're seeing England as you know, as Jack was saying earlier, it was, you know, they're winning games at a tournament and they're being criticised, and it's not by the media. I think the media are sort of towing a line between being impressed and being concerned. It's fairly balanced, I would say. The media coverage hasn't been too much this way or that way, but I think a lot of the reaction on social media is a lot more volatile, and to be honest, the players are far more connected with and engaged with what people are saying on social media than worrying about what mark out of 10 they get in a newspaper match report. You know, times have changed. They're not obsessing about what's in the papers. They're more likely to obsess about what's on their social media feed.
Yeah, and Dan, I guess we've talked about the progress that's made in the camp. I mean, 7 points and 0 goals conceded would have been marvelled at in years gone by. But like Ollie says, in the social media age, everyone's got an opinion and everything's heightened,
isn't
it?
Without a doubt. And I think if you took social media away, people would see the group standings and be thrilled with how the performances and the results have gone. But obviously, as you say, everyone on social media thinks they're Gareth Southgate, wants to be Southgate. Gareth Southgate has an idea of who they'd play, who they'd leave out. And, you know, that is one unique thing about social media. But I think, as Ollie said, I think you probably have to view it as a, you know, if England are winning and they're still being criticised, I mean, that's difficult. But I guess a lot of the criticism comes around the starting 11 and Jack Grealish, really. That's, from all I've seen, that's kind of been the most criticism that there's been. It's like, well, why isn't Jack Grealish playing? Or, you know, Jack Grealish should be playing. And then he obviously played and started in the last game and made a good impact. So that's all I've sort of seen. I don't think there's been anything too negative. I don't think, admittedly, I didn't switch on social media after the Scotland game. I'm sure there was a fair bit of criticism there. But no, I think it's just down to team selection. Let everyone's got their opinion on who should play and who shouldn't play.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is The England Show from The Athletic. Keep up to date with all of our Euro 2020 podcasts and writing by following us at The Athletic UK.
Yeah, and Jack, finally, just looking ahead, obviously you're covering England for The Athletic this tournament. Next tournament's going to be a very different one to cover, Qatar at Christmas. How unusual is that going to be?
Yeah, it's going to be very strange. In all sorts of ways. You know, I don't know what the situation's going to be with fans, with weather. It could be very hot, although it is going to be November. There's talk of air-conditioned stadiums, all the rest of it. So it's a huge step into the unknown for everyone. But of course, the weird, you know, the strange thing about the timing is that that is now only 18 months away, or rather less than that. It's probably about 17, 16 months away. So I don't think that the England team at the next World Cup will be, assuming they qualify, will be very different from the England team at the Euros now. Like, there is no one in this England setup who looks like they might retire from international football, for example. The guys in their 30s, like Henderson, Walker and Trippier, I don't think are going anywhere anytime soon. And I'm sure maybe that's why Gareth Southgate did move on from some of the older players after 2018. You know, he made a conscious decision not to pick guys like Ashley Young, for example, again. Cahill, Smalling, Jones have all kind of fallen by the Vardy. Have all fallen by the wayside. And maybe that's because Southgate didn't want a spate of retirements after this Euros before the next World Cup. So I don't think it will be a very different England team, but and I'm sure Southgate will be there as well.
Ollie, do you think what they're doing now is building towards the World Cup, or do you think they're firmly focused on this Euros and what they're doing in this Euros?
Yeah, I think initially, I mean, there was for once a sort of long-term plan at the FA when Southgate was appointed, and they looked at the nature of the squad, and it felt it was a very young squad, and they felt that looking at the players who were coming through the development teams at that point, they were going to have to sort of build towards being competitive at 2022. They didn't feel like there was going to be any opportunity to really compete to win a tournament till 2022. Now, that might sound a really downbeat assessment, but they felt that they needed to build towards that, and so that, you know, I think the 2018 reaching a semi-final, albeit via a fairly gentle draw, really was ahead of schedule. It probably raised expectations, and I think also the fact that this tournament is taking place a year later than planned, it's only 18 months short of the World Cup, and you know, they are looking at it as a tournament that they can compete to win. 2022 has been the long-term target for a long time. There was a countdown clock at St. George's Park for a while. I don't know if it's still there, in the coaches' room, which was counting down to the 2022 World Cup. And there was a feeling among some at the FA that, look, that's just sort of almost like kicking the can down the road. It's, you know, you're just sort of making excuses for the next four tournaments if you're saying that 2022 is the one we're going to win. So there is now this sense that, yes, they are building towards 2022, 2024, 2026, but this is a tournament that they can win, because if you look at, you know, they have ended up on the right side of the draw after all the debates about whether they would want to finish second or first in the group. They've got a really tough game against Germany on Tuesday, but there is probably a feeling in both of those camps that if England or Germany, well, one of them will get through, whichever of them gets through, will really fancy themselves to get through the rest of the draw to get to the final. So I applaud the sort of long-term vision that they've taken. I think it's done a lot of good, but I think now that they're there and they're in the last 16, you've got to go for it. Seize the opportunity, even if, yes, there is an important long-term building aspect that we shouldn't forget either.
Well, so that about wraps it up for this episode. Thanks ever so much to the guys for joining me to chat through what's going on at St. George's Park currently. And if you do want to check out Dan's piece and you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, then all you've got to do is go to theathletic.com/englandpod and you'll be able to sign up for just £1 a month. You'll read Dan's piece and you'll read everything else that's good on The Athletic. I'll be back tomorrow with Jack again, Mark Chapman and Flo Lloyd-Hughes with a full preview of England v Germany. Take care.
The Athletic.